Shalom and welcome everyone to the ICEJ webinar. We're so glad you've joined us once again. I'm David Parsons, Senior Vice President and Spokesman for the International Christian Embassy Jerusalem, coming from our global headquarters here in Jerusalem. And we're talking today about, is the October 7 war over? And of course, we've had a ceasefire in the north with Hezbollah for just over a year now. We just passed the 1 year anniversary. And we've also got a ceasefire down in Gaza with Hamas since the middle of October. And yet there's a sense that the war is not really over. These are both one-sided ceasefires where Israel is still taking out Hezbollah weapons in Lebanon and Hamas terrorists in Gaza. And there's a sense among Israel that this may just be a pause. Are we even going to see an escalation on some of these fronts? So is the war triggered on October 7, 2023, the two-year war of Israel? Is it really, really over? And here to help us, our top guest for these military matters, IDF Major Reserve Elliot Chadoff. Good to see you, Elliot.
Good to be back with you, David.
Okay, you've been a go-to guy for us and for, I know, I-24 News, now ILTV, many other medias here, yes, here in Israel about this war. But we haven't had you on for a couple months now, since probably August, September. So we got a little ground to catch up first as we sort of set the stage for today's discussion. The first thing I want to discuss is the Gaza ceasefire and how it took shape so suddenly. I actually think, in looking back at it, that the Israeli strikes on the Hamas leadership in Doha, actually, even though they missed the people they were aiming for, it still accelerated this ceasefire. The U.S. team was able to get it done quickly. And another question that's part of it, were you surprised how quickly it came together? And were you surprised that Hamas gave up all 20 living hostages at the very start? That was their best leverage. And I'm still trying to figure out why they did that.
Well, first of all, I agree with you. I think the strike in Doha was a critical event, not necessarily in the direction that Israel planned it. Certainly, it failed in terms of hitting the targets. It certainly sent a clear message that terrorist leaders are safe nowhere, and I think that had its own impact. It also had an impact on the American administration, on President Trump, who stepped in very quickly and sharply, putting pressure on Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey to get to Hamas. And I think that also meant that Hamas was a little more amenable, if you will, to submitting to that pressure. And he put direct pressure on Israel as well. So there were a combination of things that went on there. And for him in particular, getting the hostages out was a means of getting something tangible out of the agreement. In other words, here, I don't want to make this sound like criticism, but analytically, we know President Trump is very much into, you know, showing his trophies, if you will. And the hostages provided that. So that was, I think, for him, an absolute. But we have to keep in mind, they were supposed to return all the hostages, living and dead, within 72 hours. They still haven't returned two of them. This is something that doesn't surprise me in the least. It's something I predicted even before the agreement. To answer your question, I'm a little surprised they handed over all the living ones, but I think they were put under just more pressure they could withstand. So now they're playing games with the bodies. Mm-hmm. And Qatar a few days ago said, well, you know, we shouldn't let two bodies stand in the way of going on to the next phase, which was utterly predictable. And of course, here the issue, and I don't want to make this sound wrong. It's not that the bodies are not important, but the real issue here is, do we allow Hamas to violate part of an agreement and then move on to the next part while they're still in violation of the first part? And to me, that's a grand question. So it's not really over. We're in a pause. And I think we can go into all the other parts of it that are supposed to fall into place, that Hamas is doing the exact opposite of the intention of where this plan is supposed to be going.
Okay. Let's sort of ask the question from another direction. Is the ceasefire holding? Let's talk about it this way. In the first phase of it, Israel gets back its hostages, living and dead, in exchange for some Palestinian prisoners, some other detainees released, plus the IDF has to withdraw to this yellow line, 53%.
Right.
Trump takes it to the UN Security Council to get approval. I actually think it legitimizes, the international community legitimized the IDF presence in half of Gaza until Hamas disarms. I think that was a good development. What do you see good and bad over this whole ceasefire agreement?
Getting it through the Security Council is certainly good. How important is it in the long run remains to be seen. The UN is not exactly a power organization that really imposes anything. And our experience with the UN, not only politically, but also physically on the ground, has not been a good one in general. The fact that there is a ceasefire, the hostages were returned, all positive. The fact that there is a plan, at least, on the table to disarm Hamas and to move them out of position of power is good. Not so good is the fact that Hamas basically is ignoring it. And I don't know whether to laugh or to cry when Witkoff says, but they promised they would disarm. Okay, so they did. In the meantime, they're still rebuilding their forces. They're doing everything they possibly can. They've launched attacks against Israeli troops in the course of this so-called ceasefire. We're maintaining it as best we can. It's not absolute. We've made very clear anybody who crosses the yellow line, comes near our troops, is going to be fired on, and they've done that, and they will do that. That is a Hamas method that goes back decades. And you know, before we began recording, you asked about has the October war ended, and you know, the first thing I said is I'm not sure it started on October 7th. This round may have, but we have to go back decades with both Hamas and Hezbollah, and Iran and all the rest to talk about the war as a continuation and this being a phase of it. Mm-hmm. So we're still a long way. And Israel is not going to be able to tolerate a rebuilt Hamas in Gaza. And that's very, very clear. So the question now, and more questions than answers going forward, who disarms Hamas? Who patrols in there? Who controls the strip? And the answer right now is Hamas.
I think the way you've pictured it here, it is, you're fighting an Islamist ideology, and so it's an endless jihad, and they take pauses, and you get breaks in it. And Israel fought hard for 2 years, did a lot of damage to Hamas, Hezbollah, embarrassed Iran, but this thing, it's just a pause. The war's not over.
Yes.
But how critical, I believe it's very critical that the Arab countries that forced, you mentioned Qatar, Egypt, Turkey, that forced Hamas to give up the hostages, especially the 20 living, that they continue to pressure Hamas for the sake of the people of Gaza to end the suffering, to allow the rebuilding. They have to give up some weapons. Will it be symbolic? How do you think this will play out?
Okay, so first of all, I don't believe that Qatar and Turkey did it for the good of the people of Gaza. Egypt, I'll leave as a sort of an aside, I'm not sure. But in all three cases, for sure, they saw the end of Hamas if things kept on going the way they were. And here's an interesting paradox, and it's not the first time in history that we see such a thing. Turkey, Qatar, and Egypt were more interested in rescuing Hamas than the Hamas leadership in Gaza was interested in rescuing Hamas. So they imposed longevity on them. Let's keep in mind, the leadership in Gaza, what's left of it at this point, but what was, are true believers. These are true jihadi, martyrdom-oriented characters. So for them, dying for the cause is all good and well. Qatar and Turkey in particular, and Egypt as well, looked and said, that's terrible. We don't want Hamas to be destroyed. Weakened is fine, but we still have, there's a lot of stuff that we still want to do with these guys. So they imposed survival on Hamas. And I think the humanitarian issue in the population of Gaza is window dressing. They couldn't come out and say what I just said. So they make it sound like, well, we're doing it all for the good of the people of Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. But they could have done that a year ago. They could have done that a year and a half ago.
They were preserving Hamas as a knife at Israel's side to make Israel bleed.
Yes.
Continue. Yeah.
Yes.
That's a very sober assessment. Look, this phase two of the Trump plan, where are we on it? And do you think it seems like the three things that have to be put together here, the International Stabilization Force, this Board of Peace, that Trump will be the governor of Gaza, the head of this, to oversee the rebuilding and all the funds, and the interim cabinet of Palestinian technocrats, all of them are still at the embryonic stage and going nowhere so far.
Well, first of all, they're all predicated on Hamas disarming. And here again, I don't see that happening. They're going to call it all sorts of things. They'll say they'll lock their weapons up. They'll put them away. It's all nonsense. Hamas is not going to willingly disarm. And the so-called force that goes in there that's supposed to be made up of Arab and Muslim military forces have already said they're not going to do it. That's not their job. The Europeans are certainly not going in there to disarm Hamas. So this is the first sticking point, that the only people who are capable of and willing to disarm Hamas is Israel and the IDF. And that sort of negates the whole point of this operation. So I would say that all the other points, the rebuilding, the governorship and the technocrats, that's all very interesting. But it's all stuck on the single point of what happens when Hamas says, in one way or another, no, we're not disarming, now what? Mm-hmm. And they're pretty much there.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll be easier for the IDF now, without any hostages in the tunnels, to be concerned about a lot of the tunnels being destroyed. They've just found some more. That it'll be easier for Israel to finally complete that. They need a break. They need to rearm, get themselves ready for it. But once Hamas and once their backers in Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey realize the IDF is serious in going in to finish off Hamas, are they going to step in to preserve them again and say, now you got to disarm? It seems the IDF sort of controls what happens.
No, actually, Trump controls what happens.
Exactly.
In other words, okay, if he accepts the window dressing that he will be sold by Qatar, Turkey, and Egypt, who will say, well, of course they've disarmed. They've put all of their weapons into warehouses under lock and key. What more do you want from them? If Trump says, oh, that's okay, that works for me, then Israel has a very, very severe problem. If he says, no, that doesn't work, disarm means disarm, not putting it aside where you can open your drawer and get to it in 10 minutes, and either do it or I'm going to unleash Israel on you, then we have a different outcome. Well, I'm not going to predict what his response will be, because Trump if nothing else, is unpredictable.
But if he's looking at it, something towards that end, once or twice he said that, then we're going to send Israel on you. So,
but that was then. But that was then. In other words, here, let's keep in mind that one of the variables in all of these things is time. As time goes on, he's more invested in this. He's carrying this now as a greater and greater success story. He's trying to play it out over Ukraine and Russia as well. Look, I solved 3,000 years of conflict in the Middle East. Yes. The last thing he needs while that's happening is for Israeli tanks to be rolling into, you know, the Hamas-controlled areas of Gaza. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough call. It's clear to me that Witkoff, Kushner, and Trump are looking at this in the framework of a real estate deal, and I don't mean that in the they're looking to build real estate. That's their world. That's their frame. That's what they negotiate, and it doesn't work well in international relations. The power of the United States certainly has a play in this, but these are all actors, and I'm talking about Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria, Iran, who do not work on a Western or American either cultural or political timetable. And I think that's a very important thing for us to realize. The United States political world comes to an end every 4 years. And it's a fact. And if you're a first term president, your world may be extended for another 4 years. But that's it. That's your lifespan in politics. The supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, is the second leader in Iran since the revolution in 1979. It's Khomeini and Khamenei. So from 1979 till the end of 2025, there have only been two leaders in Iran. Okay, Hassan Nasrallah was the head of Hezbollah for decades. These are people who don't think in terms of, I have to deal with elections in 2 years. And they can very, very easily sit back and say, you know what, we're going to lower things down, we'll bow our heads a bit, we'll swallow our protests, and 3 years from now, we'll do whatever we want. For Israel, that's bad news. And the question is, does the American administration play its sort of timetable based on American value time or on world value time? And again, open question. I'm afraid from experience, and not just this administration, America sees the world in 4 year kind of, you know, segments and chunks.
Yeah. I agree that for the next 3 years, Trump is the governor of Gaza. He really has a lot to say there. Israelis have conceded this to him because they credit him with getting the hostages out, standing with Israel. So far, his record on Israel is very strong. But we may be looking right now, at least the new status quo of the IDF on the yellow line in 50% of Gaza with international approval. This may be the status quo for the next 3 years, just to help out Trump and give time for Hamas to rebuild. Is that a real possibility?
I think it's a very real possibility. And the 3 years happens to coincide with my projection estimate of how long it will take for Hamas to rebuild, to be in a position to strike again against Israel.
Okay. Well, we'll move on from that gloomy projection for Gaza to the northern border and Lebanon. Before we leave Gaza, let me just ask one more thing. What's going on with the guys hiding in the tunnels under Rafah, these Hamas guys who some of them are sort of poking their heads up and getting shot at and trying to shoot as well?
Look, they're trapped. They've been given legitimately by Israel two options, surrender or die. And, you know, you can choose the way you die. You want to stay down there till you starve to death. You want to come up and try to attack us and we'll fire on you. That's entirely up to you. If you want to survive this experience, come up, surrender. We'll process you through, and then we can talk about what happens afterwards. And they're not giving up. A few of them did, but most of them are not. And we'll see what happens as their food completely runs out, and whether they choose, you know, option A or option B when they to come out of the tunnels.
Yeah, I think there have been some Arab interlocutors trying to work out if they give up their weapons, they can go into exile. But Israel's playing tough on that front.
Yep.
That's excellent.
Yes.
Okay. Because a lot of these, they took up arms. They were probably involved in October 7. They deserve to be dealt with. Yeah. Okay. On the Lebanese front, we have just passed the one-year anniversary of the ceasefire up there, but it's similar. Already shown us that sure, there's a ceasefire, but it's a one-way truce that Israel is still targeting Hezbollah as it's trying to rearm. Hezbollah has done very little that we can point to in response. And Israel was maximal pressure to punish any violations of the ceasefire. Where do we stand on this front, and where do you see it going?
Okay, I call it zero tolerance, but essentially the same idea. I think it would be a good way to start would be to talk about the differences, two critical differences between Gaza and Lebanon in the ceasefires. The first critical difference is that in Gaza, there is a ceasefire as part of a grander future plan. In other words, phase one is ceasefire for hostages. And again, given the violation, they're still holding two bodies. Essentially, it's ceasefire for hostages. In Lebanon, we have an extensive agreement that includes a ceasefire. And that agreement is with the Lebanese government, and that's the second important point. Hamas is, for all intents and purposes, sovereign in its areas of Gaza. There's nobody above them. Hezbollah is not nominally sovereign in Lebanon. There's a Lebanese government. There's a Lebanese army. And Israel's agreement is with Lebanon that Hezbollah does not reestablish itself south of the Litani River near the Israeli border. It doesn't rebuild. It disarms, and so on and so forth. And with that, there's a ceasefire. So when Hezbollah violates the agreement, and it's when, because they've been doing it since day before one of the agreement, we strike, and that's the zero tolerance, whether it's their attempts to move back into South Lebanon or to rebuild in other places. They're still getting weapons from Iran. It's much more difficult for them with Syria out of the picture, but they're still doing it. In other words, Hezbollah is doing everything it possibly can to rebuild itself. And the so-called chief of staff who we took out this past week was instrumental in that rebuilding. And that was part of one of the many reasons why he was targeted. The fact that it is within Lebanon also makes things potentially better and more complicated at the same time. Lebanon, President Aoun of Lebanon, I'm sure would like to disarm Hezbollah. Okay, Hezbollah is the only armed militia in Lebanon by the Taif Agreement of 1989, which disarmed all of the militias except for Hezbollah, which essentially allowed Hezbollah to do whatever it wanted in Lebanon because they were the only armed non-Lebanese army force. We weakened them in the course of the war that ended about a year ago, or the round, if you will, that ended about a year ago, and hoped that that would promote or project the Lebanese government into a position where it would pick up the slack and disarm what was left of Hezbollah. They did not do that. And we're now in a situation where Aoun, the president of Lebanon, who would very much like to, because I mean, Hezbollah, an armed Hezbollah is not good for his country, and he knows it, is caught on the horns of a dilemma, and I don't envy him. His army is made up in large part of Shiites, and it's not clear whether they will follow orders if given orders to disarm Hezbollah. The second stage of that is, even if they do follow the orders, it's not clear that they will succeed. In other words, Hezbollah might actually beat them in battle. If either of those things happen, either an army refusal or an army defeat, Lebanon essentially ceases to exist as a country. And I believe that with all of his wishing to disarm them, Aoun would rather live with the uncertainty than take the risk of failing. And that's where we're standing today. Of course, he's also condemning Israel for striking at Hezbollah, because here again, our strikes are not good for Lebanon in the sovereignty sense. We're doing what we have to do for our protection. And he's really caught in this very, very difficult situation. I sympathize with him. He's still the enemy, but I can sympathize with his position that Hezbollah may be too strong for him to disarm. And the only way for them to be weakened is by Israel striking them, which is also anathema for Lebanon. So he's caught.
Yeah, I think most Lebanese still have an aversion because of the long, bitter and painful civil war back in the 70s and 80s. They don't want the country to descend in civil war again. And you're probably right. This was a good analysis of the situation there. Israel still, whatever it sees across the border, is going to try and be precise in hitting it. And I think it would only, it would take help from the U.S., from France and others. UNIFIL's still there, but it's doing nothing to help with this disarmament. It would take serious international intervention.
It was never of any value.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And look, the last time America intervened in Lebanon in the 1980s, it got over 200 Marines killed in a Hezbollah bombing attack on their barracks. So it's not exactly the kind of place that I think the United States wants to send troops into with that kind of a history. Yeah. So it's a serious problem there.
I think there were 70-some French soldiers, some U.S. Diplomatic personnel at the embassy bombing, the Marine barracks bombing.
The embassy was bombed twice, yes.
Yes. Okay, let's shift over to Syria. This is an interesting front. It was the weakening of Hezbollah that sort of made the Assad regime vulnerable this time last year. And in 12 days, al-Shara and these jihadist elements swept down to Damascus and took over. And it's been a bit of a rough first year. But the IDF moved into certain parts of South Lebanon. Tell us where the IDF moved into
Syria.
And what they're doing now to protect the Druze and protect Israel.
Okay, so first of all, the belt along the Israeli border that we've moved into, along the Golan border, so moving east and essentially eastward, was a terrorist nature reserve through all the years of the Syrian war. Okay, and here again, I think this is kind of a classic Mideast soap opera, because when the Assad regime was in power, and I'm talking about Assad the father as well as Assad the son, Israel's greatest threat from Syria was from the Syrian army. And we faced it with our conventional army forces. We fought the war in 1973, and after that, learned the lessons as such, and the Golan was bolstered with the army prepared for that attack again. And I can tell you, 20-plus years ago, when we used to do exercises, and I've served in the North for a good part of my military service, every exercise would begin in what I used to call Yom Kippur War 2.0. In other words, the Syrians are launching a surprise attack. Let's, get up there and stop them. When the war broke out, the Syrian war broke out, the Assad regime was weakened, and the area along the Israeli border was taken over by terrorist organizations, all against the regime. Now, some of them were Al-Qaeda types, others were local types. And in the northern part near the Druze village, Majdal Shams, on the Israeli side, there's a Druze village on the other side, Al-Khader. They were taken over by Hezbollah. So we had Hezbollah, we had Al-Qaeda, we had Al-Nusra, we had all sorts of characters running around there. And it was a merry mess for a decade. And the Syrian army was in there, and they tried to push them out, and they failed, and seriously a mess. In many ways, much more difficult to handle than the Syrian army. Because the Syrian army, at least you knew, they had their headquarters in their place and their tanks and whatever. Here, it was literally the Wild West. 24 terrorist organizations operating along the border. When the war ended and Assad extended his power a little more toward the south, he was able to control it a little bit better. And when with the weakening of Hezbollah, as you mentioned, his regime fell. It was clearly rotten to the core. And I mean that not in value sense, I mean in power sense. Regime shouldn't collapse that quickly under that kind of pressure. What we have is now a hybrid situation in Syria. The regime is not strong enough to really control its territory, and in particular around the periphery. So once again, we have terrorist organizations moving in along our border. Whether it's Jamaat al-Islamiyya or Al-Qaeda spinoffs or whatever. We have Ashara, who's ex-Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an Al-Qaeda spinoff, but now he's okay because he wears a tie and he eats dinner at the White House. And I don't want to get into his head. I don't trust him, but you know what? I'm willing to be convinced. Below him, though, his regime is made up of all sorts of Al-Qaeda types who I don't believe are reformed. And that's part of what we've seen with the attacks on the Alawites and the attacks on the Druze. I'm not certain that that comes from Ashara. I don't want to say for sure that it doesn't. Okay. But I'm not certain that it does. But he's got enough of a second echelon and third echelon that are still jihadis. And I don't know if he has the strength to stop them. And this is also part of that, you know, kind of jockeying to stay in power. So what we have along our border, when the Assad regime fell, we moved into that zone, and we're holding it now with our forces. He wants us out of there, and I can understand him. He's not going to get it, but I can understand him. And these terrorist organizations are moving back in there and launching attacks. Now, the Israeli army is now in front of our civilian population. In other words, having moved onto the Syrian side, we now have a belt of military defense in front of the civilian population. But these guys are now attacking Israeli troops, not on grand scale, but they're attacking. They're building up for attacks. One of the guys we captured the other day with this fire, Farad Bedjan, was planning attacks from Jamaat al-Islamiyya. In other words, taking him was not punitive, it was preventive. We're trying to prevent attacks into the future. And apparently some of the people who fired on our troops were regime operatives, whatever. So a mess. And we're trying to stabilize it as best we can. The Druze situation that you mentioned is extremely complicated because there are Druze centers either along our border in the north, like in Al-Qadr, but also further to the southeast, which is not all that close to the Israeli border.
It's over near Jordan.
But we have a very large Druze population. Right. Near the Jordanian border. But we have a large Druze population in Israel. They're loyal to Israel. They serve in the military. They're officers. There have been Druze generals. These are not second-class citizens. They have a great deal of influence because of that, and legitimately so. And they are closely tied. This is their family in Syria. And we're bound to at least do something to protect them, or we're betraying our own Druze population. So that's part of the complexity of what's going on in Syria today. And it's unfolding. I don't do projections, so I'm not going to say what's going to be next week. But the guy I'm watching is Ashara. And so far, I'm not positive. I'm positive in the confident positive sense. His responses have been against Israel and not against Israel's legitimate concerns of what's happening along its border in his country.
Yeah, the jury's still out on him. He probably doesn't control some of these elements. And you mentioned, especially the Golan Druze, I think they didn't give Israel much choice or leeway. They said either the IDF goes in or we're just going to pour across the border and go fight, join our Druze brothers and fight. Yes. And Israel didn't want that. So they've been more proactive.
No. And by the way, not only the Golan Druze, the Galilee Druze as well.
And the Carmel Druze?
Carmel Druze a little less so, but the Galilee Druze for sure. And I have a lot of Druze friends and colleagues, and what I heard from them is, you know, you don't expect us to stand by and let our people get slaughtered, do you? Mm-hmm. And how do you answer that?
Yeah, those are the three main Druze communities in Israel. The Golan Druze always worried about Israel giving the Golan back to Syria, so they'd go wave right. Syrian flags. Do you think at this point they're sort of signing on with Israel for their own future?
Yes. During the Syrian war, we already saw a shift in that direction. And now in this with the recent attacks and massacres, which, by the way, are still going on, mm-hmm. just on a lower intensity. I think that they understand very clearly that they have no future in Syria.
Mm. It's been very bizarre to see some of these Syrian Druze leaders there in southern Syria say we want to be part of Israel and waving the Israeli flag.
That's right. Yes,
an unusual end to all of that. All right, and we go to the front of Judea and Samaria. How is Israel doing in handling that front that's been active in this 2-year war? But it seems the IDF has a pretty good handle on it.
Look, Judea and Samaria, in contrast to Gaza, the IDF operates inside in the territory, not necessarily on a regular basis inside the major cities, but around them. In other words, it has the ability to close them off and prevent or at least make very difficult transit between them. It's no secret that for the past 2 years, Hamas and its instigators, Iran and friends, have done everything they can to ignite Judea and Samaria as another front. And here I'll give the security services in general, the IDF, the border police, the Shabak, the general security services, very, very high grades in taking an aggressive approach as opposed to a passive defensive one to make sure that it doesn't erupt. There are terrorist attacks, and there have been, and people have been killed, and I don't want to belittle that, but it hasn't blown up as it certainly could have if Israel had taken a sort of a wait-and-see kind of a policy toward it. And that's ongoing, because there, unlike Gaza, we're not going in there with massive army forces, divisions, and tanks, and that sort of thing. It's much more special operations levels, small unit levels, if not special operations forces, and going in and targeting a terrorist concentration here or a warehouse there or an arms operation somewhere else, keeping them off balance, but not really defeating them in the sense of crushing them. So it's kind of an ongoing maintenance, if you will, rather than a decisive, we're going in and finishing it.
Okay, two other fronts on this war. It looks like Yemen, the Houthis there, they indeed were firing at Israel to support Hamas. As soon as you have a ceasefire in Gaza, they stopped. They've gone back to sea piracy of the ships and all. But Iran, the Iranian front, did Israel deal a strong enough blow in the 12-day war and in the overall war over the past 2 years that we won't hear much directly from Iran? Are they trying to rearm quickly their nuclear program? Anything you want to say about the direct Israel-Iran confrontation?
The operations with Iran, and here Again, I don't call it a 12-day war. It started when Khomeini came to power, and it'll go on as long as the Khomeiniist regime is in power. But the 12-day campaign was insufficient. It dealt them a great deal of damage, but not enough. Some of the damage that was dealt them was done in order to improve the situation for dealing more damage during the campaign, specifically taking out their military leadership and their air defenses, had an immediate impact in allowing Israel and of course, the United States in its airstrikes to strike against targets essentially freely with no opposition. An indicator that it wasn't sufficient is that last morning when Israel was sending a massive airstrike against Iranian targets and Trump ordered it called off. In other words, if there were no more targets, there would not have been a massive airstrike on its way to Iran. And I don't know if I don't believe that would have been sufficient, but it would have hit another sort of wave or phase of targets, which were not hit. So Iran now has breathing space. It's been given that by the United States. I think America is totally misreading the Iranian government. They don't want peace. They don't want tranquility. They never did, not since Khomeini. And they are rebuilding. We know they're rebuilding. They made a statement, Khamenei made a statement a couple of days ago that Iran defeated the Americans and the Zionists in the 12-day war. They're rebuilding their ballistic missile systems. They've thrown the International Atomic Energy Authority out. Some of that's symbolic, but not all of it. In other words, there was a lot left. And once again, Iran is not operating on American political time. If it takes them 5 years to rebuild, they'll do it in 5 years. If it takes them 8 years, it'll take them 8 years. I think the strategic hope that Israel had was that it could weaken the regime enough that the Iranian people would overthrow it. And here I think it's very important, especially to our American audience, the idea was not for either Israel or America to overthrow the regime. The idea is for the regime to be weakened so the Iranians overthrow the regime. It's their issue, it's their problem. And they didn't do it. And I can come up with all sorts of speculation about why they didn't do it, but they didn't do it. And we are now still with a relatively stable, in place Khomeiniist regime that is not threatened even by the fact that Tehran is going without water. There's no rioting in the streets. That tells you something. And again, I think it's a long and involved question of what it tells you, but it certainly tells you the regime has a certain stability, center of gravity, that it's not being overthrown very simply or very quickly by its population. And we have to deal with that reality, that we're going to have a radical Khomeiniist regime there into the future.
Yeah, as soon as the ceasefire was put in place back in June there, they turned their attention, the regime did, into stifling any dissent. But yes. They have domestic concerns that there are obstacles to their ability to rebuild, but it looks like China and Russia are certainly willing to help them rebuild as fast as they can.
Exactly.
And but it is harder for them to get weapons now to Hamas or Hezbollah. It seems Israel and certain other players are trying to at least stymie that effort, and that's good for Israel.
For sure. The question is how long the world will pay attention.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We thank you for your time. Any closing comments on this pause? Hard to predict what's going to happen. Some people are saying, oh, as soon as the Pope leaves Lebanon, it's going to blow up confrontation between Hezbollah and Israel. Right. I just think we're in sort of a controlled, still a lot of fighting, but the IDF really is calling a lot of the shots here.
I'll close with a quote from a briefing that I was in about a decade ago in Northern Command of the IDF, where I was staff officer at the time, and the commanding general of the north of Israel got up to open the briefing, and he said the following, and this is more or less verbatim translated from Hebrew. He said, "I can guarantee that a war is not going to break out over the next hour. After that, it's anybody's guess."
So, okay, till this briefing's over, okay? So folks, as you watch this, there won't be a war while you're watching this webinar. All right. Appreciate your time, right. IDF Major in the Reserves, Elliot Chadoff. Once again, it's great to have you back on the ICJ webinar. God bless you from Jerusalem. And we want to thank everyone who's joined us on the webinar today. We'll be back next week, Thursday, 3 p.m. Israel time, with another ICEJ webinar. God bless you from Jerusalem.